Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to start in about 1 minute, so if you would please take your seats. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome publisher Forbes magazine, Mr. Rich Carlgaard.
Well, welcome back, everybody. George and I and Andy Kessler and Brett Swanson were talking about the 10th anniversary and how many people have been here all 10 years, and we had, and I think Ashby Foote has too. So a round of applause for Ashby Foote. Now, I remember 10 years ago in Palm Springs, we were really fortunate to have Mike Milken as one of our speakers and here to grace our 10th anniversary of Telecosm. He's back, one of the giants of finance and philanthropy, who's going to give a 45-minute talk on globalism and social capital. It's an amazing career. I could go on, and I shouldn't because we're a little late, and I'll detract from his presentation if I do, but his involvement in medical philanthropy, education philanthropy, his recent travels around the world, his views on social capital and globalism, you won't want to miss. I want to make one more pitch, and that is if there's another conference you go to other than Telecosm, go to the Milken Foundation's global conference, which is every spring. It will save you a lot of wear and tear from going to Davos, and you'll get a lot better information. They actually believe in capitalism, I believe, at the Milken Foundation Global Conference. So without further ado, let's give a warm welcome to Mike Milken.
Well, it's great to be here. I have delivered classes by using just one Forbes magazine. The issues that came out in 1957, you know, gave me a chance to think about a lot of things. With George, many people think of George as the world's greatest optimist. I kind of think of George as the world's second greatest optimist. And I would say that it isn't often discussed enough, but when you reflect on thousands and thousands of years of civilization, and going back, let's say, 11,000 years when the concept of agriculture really began, and you look at growth rates, we really don't reflect enough upon it, but you would see that the growth rate, let's say, from 0 to 1,000 was absolute zero. There was no growth in per capita income for 1,000 years. There was little to no growth in population during that period of time either. The growth rate from 1,000 to 1,500 ranged at 1/20th of 1% per year for per capita income. It would double in 1,400 years. There wasn't much change between 1,500 and 1,820, somewhat of a pickup. But the real growth of per capita income, GDP, population, everything really began around 1820 when you start to measure it. And it's somewhat hard to reflect as you think about the span of time of really how little occurred besides evolution up till about less than 200 years ago and what has accomplished. So, since you've been so busy, I thought I would show you a 2-minute little clip here that summarizes the last 12 billion years in case you missed a few of them. Thank you. So that's a quick look at the last 12 billion years. And I thought if we reflected quickly on what are the great achievements in history, some of the great achievements, and each century, each millennium, we might pick one. But for me, particularly as I've entered my seventh decade here, I'm really excited about this extension of life expectancy. And some of you might not know it, but at the start of the 20th century in the United States, one in five American babies did not see their fifth birthday. It didn't make a difference how powerful you were. If you're the most powerful person in the world, the President of the United States, one in three American presidents has lost a child, including George Bush, Bush 41, before their fifth birthday. Technology and medicine had not developed in many of these cases, obviously, to save the life of that child. In the 20th century alone, we've seen life expectancy on planet Earth go from 31 to 66 years. In spite of AIDS, in spite of malaria, in spite of wars, in spite of all these issues, more than a doubling of life expectancy on the planet, and the fact that half of every person that's ever lived to the age of 65 is alive today. In the United States, we went from 50 to 77. And we have some very good news as we look at this, and that is the percentage of men in just a period of time of 20 years, from the 1970s to the 1990s, the percentage of men who were in good health, this shows you the negative side, those in poor health, shifted 12 years. So therefore, the quality of health for a man has shifted 12 years. A 58-year-old man in the 1970s is very similar to the health of a 70-year-old man in the 1990s. We've also seen, as we've looked at probability and mortality, that it has shifted also. So the probability of an individual dying in the next year, those curves, as you can see here, have shifted dramatically over the years. And so when we say 60 is the new 40, we can prove that statistically today and what is happening biologically and the health. However, we can see here that in spite of this amazing increase for men, that we still have a situation that a 59-year-old man is still in the same physical condition as a 63-year-old woman. So we have narrowed the gap, but women are still in better shape than men. In fact, when you look at the image of a woman in the media, this is what it looked like if you want to step back to the 1950s and 60s. And a 60-year-old woman was characterized, as you can see in this picture. If you focus more on today's magazines, that curve has shifted dramatically. And that 60-year-old woman is more like a 90-year-old woman would be today, as characterized in the media, and I can assure you that many of the actresses that are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s are very excited by that fact. These great achievements in the 20th century, what about the 21st century? Bob Fogel, Nobel Prize winner, has done a lot of work in this area, is projecting that average life expectancy in the 21st century in this country will go to approximately 110. And that a child born today most likely have average life expectancy of 110. So today I thought I would briefly talk and touch on six topics. Seeing the world through new eyes, America's responses to challenges. I'd like to start there if I could. For America to bounce back from a blow, it is to overcome its wounded national pride. In Washington, there's more concern than the city has known since Pearl Harbor. People are scared. Many have panicked. They're searching for someone to blame. There's a sudden crisis of confidence forcing the United States to change its priorities. This headline did not appear as it related to 9/11. This headline did not appear as it related to Katrina. These headlines occurred in the Washington Post, New York Times in 1957 when Sputnik went up. And it singled a number of things to the United States. And what did this country, the United States, look like in 1957? There was primarily three major cars that were being sold, Ford, Chevy, and Plymouth. There was primarily just three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. If you went to buy ice cream or yogurt, there was primarily just three flavors. There was one telephone company. There was one major company in interstate commerce. It cost $2 million per megabyte for computer storage. And stock commissions, prior to my going to Wall Street at that time, cost you $75 versus $4 to buy a share of stock today. International calls, some of you might remember, $12 a minute. It made outsourcing not a good strategy. There were only 48 states. We had one woman in the Senate. And the number one song in 1957 was April Love by Pat Boone. And we had 253,000 cancer deaths. Many people thought it was a highlight for the Soviet Union. It was their statement to the world that they were more advanced in science. What it was the end of the Soviet Union. It set into motion in the United States a concern. We changed our focus in math and science. It woke up a sleeping country. The President of the United States stood up in 1961 and told us, we're going to set a man on the moon within a decade. By 1969, we had put a man on the moon. And so the question for many of us today is, where's Sputnik today? Where is our wake-up call today? Is our wake-up call in Western Europe and the United States the fact there are 600 million children under 14 in China and India, whose future buying power will grow at least as fast as their improving educations that are increasing dramatically? Is a wake-up call that China is going to become the largest English-speaking nation, as all children by 2015 are required to be fluent in English? And in fact, Gordon Brown, who's probably going to lead Great Britain this year, has pointed out there'll probably be more people speaking English in China by 2025 than all countries which consider themselves to be English-speaking countries. Is our wake-up call the California exit exam? Well, we had a chance to read that the appellate court had stayed it for a while. This exam was supposed to go in effect a number of years ago, so 1 in 7 and 1 in 8 children in America are graduating from California high schools. What is this exam? You have to get a high F once in your life on an 8th grade math test to be proficient in mathematics. You have to get a low D once in your life on an English test. You can misspell in your 1-page essay one word on every single line and still pass. Is this our competition that we're affording for our children in the next generation? California State University freshmen are considered to be rigorous students, more than 300,000 of them. They had to have a 3.0 average for generally and took college preparatory courses. 45% of all incoming freshmen need remedial English, are generally proficient at the 6th, 7th, or 8th grade level. And in mathematics, 36% are not proficient at the 8th or 9th grade level in mathematics. And now we're talking about that percentage that goes to the university. Is the wake-up call Singapore and their Biopolis? Their commitment of $5 billion to become the leading medical research center of the world? Is it their ability under Philip Yeo's leadership to recruit the world's greatest scientists to Singapore from the United States, Germany, Japan, UK, and other nations? Is it Philip Yeo's and Singapore's commitment to financially supporting the world's best and brightest students and having them, after their graduation, come to Singapore Green to fund up to $400,000 for your college graduate, MD, PhD programs, fly you, cover your costs, your parents' visits, help you with visas, in exchange and supporting you when you return to Singapore to do your work as they try to identify it. Or is the wake-up call GE's announcement at the end of 2004, the world's leading industrial company, that 60% of the growth of the company between 2005 and 2015 will be in developing countries as they divert their resources more to those areas. Seeing the world through new eyes, one of the things the United States is so unbelievable when you think about it is the willingness to change its face, the willingness to realize that by the middle of this century, the United States will be a country primarily consisting of people whose ancestors came from Latin America or Asia. In 40 years, you can see we've gone from a country where 85% of everyone not born in the United States came from Europe or Canada to 77% of everyone not born in the United States coming from Latin America or Asia. The realization that most of the young people, idealistic, hardworking, people are going to move into middle management. Most of those young people live in Asia, and only 7%, thanks to the population boom in Mexico, but only 7% live in North America. As we step back and try to take a look at the world today, I think it's easy to see what everyone pretty much knows. The U.S. is the world's largest economy at 28.4%. Japan's second, Germany's third, U.K.'s fourth, and so on. What are the projections? Well, four of those 10 countries are projected to drop out of the 10 largest world economies as you're focusing on where your customers are, where your opportunities are. And so by the middle of this century, we will find that France, Italy, Canada, Spain leave that group, and in their place comes what are often referred to as the BRIC countries. And so yes, by 2050, China will pass the United States as the world's largest economy, but Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, and Mexico will join this list. But very interesting on that list, you'll see that there is a tenfold increase in India in their percentage of the world's economy as we focus on the growth rate. One of the things that we often don't look back enough to understand where we came from, and I think it was more surprising as we did the work this year and looked at it, what did the world look like in 1820? And in 1820, China was the world's leading economic power, largest economy. India was second, France was third, and the enormous success story of two centuries. The United States was similar to its percentage of the world's economy in 1820 to what India is today. And if you step back and look at 200 years and say, well, you met Rip Van Winkle and you fell asleep for 200 years, well, you could say, well, nothing really changed. China, India, and the United States had 50% of the world's economy in 1820, and they're projected to have 50% of the world's economy in 2020. There has been a change. I'm sure those of you who have had a chance to look at it have seen what's happened just with the preparation of U.S. tax returns. At the current growth rates, 90% of all U.S. tax returns will be done in India by 2015. Medical tourism, an area that's, you know, a topic of this conference in terms of where medicine's going in science, 150,000 people went to India in 2004 to have medical procedures, one of the fastest growing industries in the world. 14 countries today, including Malaysia and South Africa, advertise medical tourism. You have a higher chance by a factor of 3 of dying from a heart valve transplant here in the United States than you do in India. And then cost here runs as much as tenfold. We've only begun to see the movement as people look to reduce medical costs similar to other costs to other parts of the world where they have organizations that specialize in only doing one procedure with the most modern technology. In finance, there's 5 countries today, there'll be more in the future, who've accumulated hundreds of billions of dollars, whose populations are very small, And therefore, starting with Norway, who now exceeds $50,000, equivalent to about $13 trillion in the U.S., in their savings in funds that are not to be used at this time internally in their country, not to repeat the mistakes that Japan made with massive inflation in the 1980s. What are they going to do with this capital? Are they going to use it for medical research, better medical treatments, education to become centers of learning and hospitals? But today we're looking at countries that are being transformed by their enormous liquidity and their desire to change their countries. Just recently, I was in Abu Dhabi, and they opened a little more than a month ago the world's most modern facility, paperless facility, the Imperial College. It's managed and staffed by people from Imperial College. Diabetes Center in Abu Dhabi. They have the second highest incidence in the world in spite of the fact that only 2% of their population is over 65. Every modern piece of machinery that GE, Siemens, Varian, anyone had ever thought of selling exists in that center. There is no paper. All your data is automatically read into your medical record. And so if you want to be treated for diabetes and tested, this would be the most advanced facility in the world. It's not in England. It's not in the United States. It's not in Singapore. It's in Abu Dhabi. We've had an enormous advantage here in the United States with this democratization of capital. I went to Berkeley in 1964. It was an exciting place to be. The first year the baby boomers went to college, this being the first year the baby boomers have turned 60. But it was really the Watts riots in 1965 that caused me to change from thinking about being an astronaut to focused on civil rights, and that access to capital was a civil rights. You didn't have to go to Vietnam to see fire on the street. Armed personnel carriers patrolling, you could see it in downtown Los Angeles. Went back to Berkeley and created my little formula on prosperity that has directed much of my life over the last 40 years. And that formula essentially is saying access to capital has a multiplier effect on social capital, human capital, and real assets, with the largest in terms of value lying in human capital and social capital. But if you don't have access to capital, all this enormous talent has little effect. It's sometimes hard even to reflect the short period of time. And in 1970, none of these things existed. Everything we take for granted today, whether it's direct deposit, securitizing mortgages, which eliminated discrimination, high-yielder junk bonds, derivatives to hedge interest rates, price fluctuations, currencies, none of this existed only 35 years ago. Today, it has all been taken for granted, and it's provided a tremendous opportunity, particularly to technology, entrepreneurs, and others in this democratization of capital. Many people have been written about George Gilder and Forbes over the past 20 to 30 years. They have all benefited from accesses to billions of dollars of capital. An amazing thing happened in the U.S. This amazing thing of creating 62 million jobs by small and medium businesses in just 30 years versus minus 4 million by large companies. And when you look at the total implementation by the early 1980s of most of these technologies, you can see the enormous separation in growth rate of what occurred in job creation in the U.S. If you want to compare this to Western Europe, who had 400 million people when the U.S. had 200. U.S. created 58 million new jobs. Western Europe created 12 on twice the population. The minute the U.K. adopted these financial innovations versus Germany and others, coupled with government leadership, you can see a dramatic change that occurred in the early 90s between Great Britain and its unemployment and the rest of the leading economies. Hernando de Soto said many years ago that for the past 30 years, the poor in more places have been more interested in becoming entrepreneurs than revolutionaries. His definition of a terrorist was an entrepreneur who didn't have access to capital. When you look at places like Egypt and Mexico today and see what could happen just with the implementation of something as simple as securitized mortgages, you'll see, as Hernando de Soto refers to it, there is more debt capital tied up in Mexico and Egypt with the inability to borrow against their homes than all the financial aid and foreign aid that's gone into either of those countries over 200 years. The minute we adopt securitized mortgages, which require rule of law, property rights, etc., throughout the world, we estimate the Milken Institute that more than $50 trillion will be awash in the world looking for something to invest in. If you look at the U.S. today, residential securitized mortgages in the United States total almost 95% of the U.S. GDP. Germany at 69, Japan is 36, and one of the unbelievable opportunities in Russia is less than 1% of the GDP is found in securitized mortgages. Imagine what would happen to the residential real estate market in the United States if you had to put 90% equity down rather than somewhere between 0 and 30. The most powerful force in the world. Now, all of you might decide what you think that is. Einstein was asked that question many years ago. What is the most powerful force the world has ever produced? He answered that question very simply, compounding. And there's your growth formula. He said compound interest. We all in the financial world might know that formula by a little different change, A equals PE to the RT. But is what is the rate of growth? Is what you're doing growing or is it decaying? It has factors in almost everything we do. The explosion in the last 200 years was greatly due. And that shows that thing that you can, none of you can read, shows you that population going almost straight up due to the advent of technology, with most of that occurring in the last 200 years out of a chart that covers 11,000 years. If we look at prostate cancer versus melanoma, prostate cancer is a slow-growing cancer, and by the time most people are diagnosed, that cancer has been growing in your body generally for about 5 years before you're even diagnosed. The sense of urgency in prostate cancer initial diagnosis, if it's confined, is not the same as melanoma. You might be able to make a decision in a month, 2 months, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months. It might not make any difference in the outcome if you waited a year. And so after 1 year, generally prostate cancer cells will double in about a year. Melanoma, on the other hand, as it grows at a much faster rate, and if you had a billion cancer cells, melanoma cancer cells in January, at a normal growth of melanoma, you would have 4 trillion melanoma cancer cells the following January. So how you treat, how you deal with the disease, in this case, 2 forms of cancer, is greatly due to the issue of those growth rates, and that's why Einstein answered that way. If we look at just the cost of sequencing a gene, more than $100 million in 1974, on its way to 3 cents. So here we have a lot of opportunities as this cost has dropped. The financial world is obviously dominated by this. If you wanted to save $1 million in the United States, someone would have laughed at you in 1999 if you thought you only were going to get 12% rate of return on your money. Well, assuming you could get 12%, all you need to do is save $1,300 a year and you have $1 million in 40 years, or just one-time investment of $10,700. In Japan, where if you achieved a zero rate of return, you'd have had the best performing portfolio over the past 18 years, zero, you would have to put away $25,000 a year. So this concept of savings rates really is meaningless that people talk about. It's really, what is the rate of return on those assets? In the case of Japan, they invested almost $4 trillion to try to jumpstart their economy with, at best, a zero rate of return. If we looked at it another way and looked at the pension funds in the United States and commitments they've made, whether they're governments or companies, companies that were confused and that they thought they were a government, the compounding of those things has driven us from just an 01, which was reported at a significant surplus, to enormous deficits today. human capital, the most valuable and important asset on earth. We put out recently at the Milken Institute and from the Federal Reserve, this is the 2006 estimate of the U.S. household balance sheet, $66 trillion, the largest asset category again for 34 out of the last 36 years, real estate. But Gary Becker, when he won his Nobel Prize in 1992, reminded us a long time ago that that is the wrong balance sheet. It's the wrong balance sheet for the companies that are presented today, this idea of cash, assets, et cetera, because the most important part, and Gary said it took up three quarters of the value, was not on the balance sheet, and that is the value of the people that work for the company. That value dwarfs any other value we know today. And so as we step back and look at this human capital, there's a lot of different ways to create it. And if we look at the CEOs of some of our larger companies today, one of the ways to create it, and what I think will define the 21st century, is this competition for human capital. And so all of those CEOs, all 10 of them, none of them were born in the United States. All of them came here, and we estimate more than $500 billion a year of human capital has come to the United States on average over the past 40 years. There's a lot of ways to create human capital. One we've seen by go to another part of the world and create it, but that's a zero-sum game. And the two areas that really create it the most are education and health, the two largest sectors of the world's economy. And as each of us here think about what's important, you know, to me, the question is, can you build an environment, can you build a society that's sustainable for our children and our children's children? And one of the things you see when you analyze education, and China understands it very well, is that another Nobel Prize winner, James Heckman, who did the work, pointed out that the highest return in education is for children prior to their sixth birthday. In fact, a dollar invested in a five-year-old gives you the same absolute output as $3 in a 15-year-old, and $5 in a 22-year-old, and $10 in a 30-year-old. So if you're going to invest in education, his work and most scholars' work has shown you want to invest early. In China today, they spend 3 to 4 times as much money on early childcare education as they spend going to college. In my own activities, after I understood the research, being a research-driven individual, we have at Knowledge Universe gone out and bought and built what would be the world's largest early childcare company, Knowledge Learning Corp, KindyCare, Children's World, and others. Using modern technology and really the last major sector of the world to deploy the technology you're talking about today. And George Gilder was involved with us at the beginning. We went out and built an online elementary school, middle schools, high schools, operating under K-12 and other backgrounds. Keystone National High School, we now have had 200,000 students. A whole new industry was started in the United States. Virtual charter schools, where a student could go to school on a computer anywhere and still participate in the after-school programs, and the government paid for it. And I think we're all fully aware of the explosive growth of online colleges to afford people an opportunity on an asynchronous basis anywhere at any time to continue their education, and the enormous growth in our activities have been in Cardian University and in conjunction with Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, University of Chicago, Columbia, and Ellis College in conjunction with the New York Institute of Technology. And we're very excited to report that our latest partnership is going to be with the only 4-year private college in the state of Nevada, Sierra Nevada College, and how we built that into a major college and university. Many of you have chosen to do things for profit. Many of you have chosen to do things nonprofit. And our activity in those growth curves that Einstein talked about was try to figure out how you can leverage. Yesterday, and if you're ever not feeling good, I'd be more than happy to take you with me. We got to surprise 2 teachers in Seattle, another one tomorrow in Nevada with these educator awards. They are assemblies in schools. All the children in the school, all the teachers, all the community leaders are in those gyms, assembly rooms, expecting the school to get some prize for good attendance, good test scores. And By the time that ceremony is over, one teacher's received one of our National Educator Awards. More than 2,100 have received them now. They receive 25,000, maybe up to 75,000 in professional development. It is our Academy Award activity, in this case, for teachers, and no child, no teacher will ever forget that day. In terms of compensation, those of you who do believe in capitalism and do believe that there's differences in abilities, I'm happy to report, under my brother Lowell's particular guidance, we and the National Institute of Excellence in Teaching, which is a foundation spun out from the Milken Family Foundation, we now have about 14 or 15 states that have teacher advancement program, which provides multiple career paths, but basically four levels of compensation for teachers based on their ability at this time. Health, the world's largest sector. I don't think I have to speak about that. I think we all know. It's projected to continue growth and might even make up 20% of our economy. And that might be good, not bad, and that we can all love to live longer, healthier lives. This was a cartoon, I think, that symbolized some of the thoughts recently. What's that last item, if you can't read it on the sticker? Okay, it tells you it's a bypass operation for one of our retirees. So the concept of what the price of that car that you're buying and what percent of that is going for health care has obviously been something that's helped lead to somewhat the demise of many of our leading companies. However, improvements in life expectancy has been estimated by Kevin Murphy and Bob Topal, who do a lot of work with the Milken Institute. Kevin won on MacArthur and a couple years ago was voted the leading economist under 40 in the world, has added $2.6 trillion a year to national wealth. That's $2.6 trillion per year for a period of almost 30 years. If I asked each one of you, what would you pay? What percent of your net worth would you give for 1 year of quality life at every age? I asked that question to John Kluge the other day at 92. What is one more year of quality life worth to him, and what percent of his $9 or $10 billion he's going to give to his foundation would he be willing to invest to help? Tremendous growth in life expectancy in the United States, particularly in the last 25 years, has been driven by amazing improvements thanks to our pharmaceutical and biotech industries, particularly in heart disease, the reduction in death from strokes, from heart attacks, etc. As you can see here, that cancer line has been flat and now exceeds. And at the current advances in heart disease, it is now projected that 30% of all Americans will die from cancer as a cause of their death. And that includes traffic accidents and any other causes. A woman has a 1 in 3 chance of getting cancer in their lifetime, a man 1 in 2. Most common cancer for a man is prostate cancer. So 33% of all cases for men are prostate cancer, and a man effectively has a 1 in 6 chance of being diagnosed with prostate cancer in the United States. But over the past 10, 15 years, there's been enormous progress with this acceleration of research, and the death rate is now 50% of what had been projected for prostate cancer. And for overall cancer, it's now been announced that for the first time in 70 years, that the absolute number of people that died from cancer in the United States in 1 year has dropped. And I think we have a goal here to reduce cancer deaths, and in fact, our goal is to eliminate them within a decade. Now, what can we all do? Lifestyle plays a big role. You can't blame everything on your parents and genes, no matter how much technology gives us, and until we get personalized medicine through all the advents of technology, which you're going to hear about in the next couple days, 70%, we estimate, of all medical cost is related to lifestyle. It's your fault, how you lived your life, what you drank, what you ate, what you breathed, etc. And it's been really hard, I can tell you, convincing everyone in the United States or the world that it is nutrition. As we all know, Yum Brands is going to make more money in China this year than they are in the United States, with Kentucky Fried Chicken and Taco Bell and Pizza Hut. One of the reasons is that it was not that long ago that doctors were the leading spokesperson for cigarettes. You might remember this ad. Here's an ad, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. It was a popular ad, and they appeared on all television shows in the 50s and 60s, endorsing specific brands. Now, California is known as a health far-out medium, but it doesn't always work in California, and this picture is from Southern California. This is a picture of a fitness center in Southern California. And as you can see, it's just too much to actually walk up those 10 steps up or down. So they fitted out this brand new fitness center with an escalator. America's weight problem, I think we're fully aware of it. It's going to be interesting to see in evolution how we deal with a group that has grown so fast, so quick. It takes hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. And 1 in 80 men, this is an unbelievable statistic, weighs more than 300 pounds. 1 of 80 men in the United States today weighs more than 300 pounds. Quality of life, can we increase productivity? Japan has today almost 6 years more of what we would call quality of life changes. So I've put out cookbooks. We've funded 1,200 programs around the world. And I thought, boy, when I turned on the Super Bowl in January of this year, or early February, we had made a lot of progress as we were sitting around, and up on my television screen comes a commercial, which I'm going to show you in a minute, that was shown at the Super Bowl. Now, you might remember in the first Super Bowl, that was Kramer from Green Bay, that the average lineman only weighed 250 pounds. However, within 40 years, the average lineman now weighs 305 pounds in the NFL. In fact, in 1980, there was not one player in the Professional Football League that weighed 300 pounds. By 2006, 26 years later, 300 players, and two of those announced that they're going to work out. And when they come back next year, they're going to be the first players ever to weigh 400 pounds that played in the National Football League. So with that excitement and watching the game, here was a commercial that ran during last year's Super Bowl.
Warren Sapp is a Pro Bowl defensive tackle. Warren Sapp is a hungry man. Packed with extra-large portions of the food men love, Hungry Man satisfies even the biggest appetites. Hungry Man, it's good to be full.
Okay, I want to show you, I know you've been tied up, but in your frozen food section, you can get a Hungry Man breakfast here. It gives you 61 grams of fat in a frozen breakfast, 21 saturated, as you can see here. Knocks out 255 milligrams for cholesterol and can give you 1,200 calories just at breakfast. So, therefore, we're not really optimistic at this point. We're going to see a turn, but we think it's coming. Achieving faster returns and achieving faster cures for our medical research and our efforts. A number of years ago, we formed Faster Cures. It was an organization dedicated to essentially shortening the time to bring cures and better treatments for basically life-threatening diseases. After 30 years of medical research, we concluded it wasn't really the pace of medical research that was slowing things down. And I made an analogy to a train, and if any of you have taken the train in Shanghai that's traveling at 270, 280 miles an hour. In theory, a train today can go 300 miles an hour. In the United States, however, and today, a train travels at the exact same speed. It's kind of amazing. The exact same speed it traveled at 100 years ago. So it is not technology and it's not really the trains. What we concluded was it's the tracks. And basically, these trains are running on 19th and 20th century tracks. and our medical science has been using 19th and 20th century thinking. There was a lot of barriers to progress that we identified, and those barriers have nothing to do with technology, etc., but these legislative ideas and infrastructure and forms to be filled out all relate to the 19th and 20th century, don't relate to technology today. We formed a TRAIN network, and our TRAIN was basically the Research Acceleration Innovation Network, where we went out and took 30 diseases, categories, brought the leaders in each of those areas together, tried to find best practices, what worked, what didn't work, whether it was lung cancer or leukemia or diabetes. And we've changed the way things are occurring. One of the great potentials in the United States is things like have occurred in Abu Dhabi here as wake-up calls that other people can do things much faster. If you have nothing, as we all understand, if you start at zero, it's a lot easier to build than to rebuild. So if you have no records, it's a lot easier to start with just digitization of those records. So in conclusion today, I really tried to, it's leading up to the conclusion, to think of, could I express this to you in 15 seconds? That doing things the same old way doesn't cause breakthroughs, and this is something we've been using at Faster Cures. Let me know if you think it works. And so that's what we've been trying. We've been trying to get into the thinking of the NIH and our other medical agencies. Some of you might remember the XPRIZE that occurred in 2004. This venture of putting a private spacecraft, Spaceship One, into orbit. Yesterday it was announced the next XPRIZE, a $10 million prize, will be awarded to a team that achieves a rapid and inexpensive method of sequencing the genome, basically 100 in 10 days. Not one in 12 years, but 100 in 10 days. And I have offered, as I think many other people will, my own DNA to be deciphered along with others as part of that effort. Annie von Eschenbach, who helped me found the Prostate Cancer Foundation 12, 13 years ago, former head of the NCA, now the commissioner designate of the FDA, stated when he was head of the National Cancer Institute that we are going to eliminate cancer as a cause of death and suffering. Might be a chronic disease by the year 2015. There's a lot to do. We need a lot of teamwork, particularly in the area of technology. I went to IBM, who's become very active in medical and been partners with us. They had a new chip coming, suggested why don't we think about medical applications, and as you think about technologies that you're employing, I would suggest to you, thinking about medical applications is good business. Unfortunately, the first application for that chip is in the PlayStation 3 coming out, not for medical. But we do need teamwork, and we particularly need teamwork from your efforts in technology. One person can't do it alone. Two young, dashing guys can't do it alone. And we're sorry to put up a second-rate magazine to show you that on the cover. It takes teamwork, and I'm sure if Lance Armstrong was here today, he would tell you that his victory in 2005 was a victory for all of those people as part of his team. And we really need the technology team to eliminate by 2015 cancer and other life-threatening diseases, and we hope you decide to sign up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. That was terrific. It really is a highlight of the 10th anniversary of Telecosm. And speaking of breakthroughs, I would like to bring up my panelists who are all affecting huge breakthroughs in a field that's been around for 103 years, aviation. If Rick and Vern and Alan could come up, we'll get going. You won't want to miss this. If you don't like it, it's my doing. I own one of Alan's planes, and I'm just really excited about how technology has gotten to the point where it's embedded into aircraft design and manufacture, to the point where it's changing things in a big way, introducing new generations of very small, very fuel-efficient planes that I think are going to be the equivalent of PCs. If the commercial airline industry with its hub and spoke system, which drives us all crazy, is the mainframe computer system, then the new generation is the personal computer generation. We have Vern Rayburn of Eclipse Aviation. Vern pioneered a field now that is known as the very light jet industry, VLJs. Vern just got his first airplane fully certified by the FAA only a matter of weeks ago.
Saturday.
Just last Saturday.
Less than a week ago.
A fully equipped jet that can fly in all kinds of weather and fly up to 41,000 feet and go over 400 miles an hour for $1.5 million new. Alan Klapmeyer of Cirrus Design pioneered an airplane whose chief notable feature is that it has a parachute in the airframe with a handle in the ceiling. This is the plane I have. And if all else fails, you pull the handle and a chute explodes out of the roof and the plane floats down. It saved more than 20 lives to date. And finally, Rick Adam of Adam Aircraft, who, like Vern on the other side, comes out of the information technology industry. Rick was the CIO of Goldman Sachs and was the founder of New Era of Networks. Since this is a slightly different topic than what we've been discussing to date, I thought that each of these entrepreneurs could explain their company and talk about their airplane. I'll start with you, Rick, and work our way down.
Thanks.
I have just a couple of slides to give you an idea of what these things look like. We have a piston propeller plane, which you see on the top, and a twin fan jet. A lot of what we do is blending tried and true aviation technology with things that came out of the tech industry. So we have a very high degree of modularity built into those airplanes, like you would in a good software or hardware architecture. So the parts between those two airplanes are about 75% common, which is unusual in airplanes. We have a disruptive technology going on, and what allows us to do that is electronics that have come into the flight decks, new generation engines, and new methods for building the airframe. Up at the top is a primarily digital flight deck that the pilot's looking at, and those have been around for only 3 or 4 years. Down below, you see an analog. Probably 95% of the airplanes flying today have that analog system down below. So one of the things that makes the new generation disruptive and much more attractive is really digital support and real-time connection to satellites for the pilots. This is really Alan's slide, but I'll put it up for him. The new generation technology started with single-engine airplanes. And down at the bottom, you see the traditional architectures. Up at the top right, you see the new ones. You know, there's two things that have happened. In about a 5-year period, the new generation airplanes have A, taken the largest market share, and B, doubled the size of the market. So these new generation products are proving to be very elastic out in the marketplace. Because we're running a little bit behind, I'm gonna go through this quickly. If you bought a brand new jet today, the lowest cost jet prior to the new generation was a Cessna jet for $4.2 million. The new generation, if you look up at the top row there, are the new generation jets, Vern's and ours, and a new one from Cessna. They have about twice the price performance. So right out of the chute, the new products we're bringing out have roughly twice the value, twice the price performance or better of the airplanes we're replacing. This is going to allow a new transportation model, which I'm going to click up to really quickly here. Up at the top, you see the lowest cost way to get into a private airplane today. So up at the top are small existing business jets sold in fractions or sold in 25-hour air cards. And you can see on the vertical index, that costs $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 per airplane mile. Down at the bottom, you see sort of last minute first class coach, which can be 25 cents a mile to $1 a mile, depending on what you're doing. So in this generation, there's a fairly big spread between what it costs to get in a private airplane and what it costs to get on the airlines. And what I've done now is I've taken our airplane and overlaid it. And if you bought the whole airplane, you're now dropping from $7, $8, $9 a mile down to $6 a mile. If you put three or four people on it, you're now down to $1 per passenger mile or $2 per passenger mile. If you look at the horizontal axis, you make that trip, which is a pretty common trip, in 2 hours instead of 5 hours. So we're getting down to where we're sort of twice, three times coach, but hugely respectful of your time. And that's why these new airplanes are going to, I think, democratize the air transportation system. Particularly those of us who came out of the tech business, I think in the last 20 years, one of the lessons we've learned is that huge centralization is not natural. And the airline transportation system in the world, in the US in particular, is very highly centralized. And it needs to be distributed. And what it needs to be distributed are these new generation of airplanes. That was my introduction. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick. I would add, not long ago, just in the last month, Rick closed a $90 million round of financing led by a Silicon Valley venture capital firm called Dahl Capital Management. So the Silicon Valley venture capital crowd has now become interested in this model because of this leveraging of technology. But Alan Klapmeyer is sort of the anomaly of the three panelists in that Alan and his brother Dale are really bootstrap entrepreneurs who started in a farm in Wisconsin, tinkering around, not a lot different than Orville and Wilbur. Certified their first airplane, was it 1998. And at the end of 2005, one of their airplanes, the SR-22, the Cirrus SR-22, which is the one I have, has now become the leading seller single-engine piston airplane in the world, surpassing such previously better known names as Piper and Cessna and Beech. Alan, you want to tell us about it?
I will, and I don't have a presentation, so I'll talk briefly from here. What we really have here with all of us, but particularly with my brother and I, is a convergence in our natural passion, which is being airplane nuts. You know, we love the idea of airplanes, and we love the idea of flying, with a recognition of economics and customer value and business life. I thought the previous presentation was really interesting. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the medical industry and healthcare, and I certainly love the idea of extending our lifespan. But the way I think of it right now is just, how do I get more out of the life I've got? The only truly scarce resource we have is time. How do we get more out of time? And so combining our passion for aviation and this recognition that we all need to get more out of time, we believe that personal transportation aircraft are a natural growth industry. That if we can make airplanes easier to fly, lower the barriers to entry, if we can make them safer, if we can make them lower cost, if we can make them higher performance, then what we can do is really change, and this is the revolutionary part of it, is change how we think about transportation, how we think about the value of our time. As Rick just said, the airlines tend to have a centralized focus of transportation. I happen to be a very impatient and growing more impatient every day type of person, and nothing drives me crazier than standing in line. I don't like to stand in line. And I especially don't like to stand in line to go someplace that I don't really want to go on the way to the place I really want to go. The advantage, therefore, for us is personal aircraft, whether it be the new VLJs as they come, the larger corporate jets that are currently available, or for us right now, a new generation of light aircraft on the personal end. They're designed to be owner flown. They're designed to be easy to operate. They're designed to take you where you want to go, not you where the airline happens to want to drop you off. I flew one of our airplanes out here yesterday, and I flew into Reno instead of into Truckee because I got here in the dark, and I decided I didn't really want to fly into the mountains as it was getting dark, being a flatlander. And the reason I was late was that I had a meeting yesterday morning that ran an hour longer than it was supposed to. And then I had my wife tell me that I really should get my driver's license renewed before it expired tomorrow. And so I did, and I spent the first part of the flight out here feeling frustrated that I was 2 hours late. And then I started thinking, but the advantage is I did get to stay for the extra hour of that important meeting, and I did get my driver's license renewed, which I wouldn't have been able to do if I was waiting for an airliner or on their schedule instead of mine. I left when I was finally ready to leave. Now, what drives all of this, of course, is new technology, and all three of us will end up talking more about that. But it's information technology applied to airplanes. How do we give pilots better information so that they can be decision makers instead of data collectors? The act of flying, how many people are pilots? Raise your hand. Okay, pretty good number. That's great. For those of you who aren't, you're supposed to look at the others in awe and say, wow, Superman. But in fact, flying isn't that difficult. The act of manipulating the controls is fairly simple. People typically solo in 10, 15, 20 hours, fly an airplane by themselves. The hard part is learning to make the right decisions, learning all of the aspects of dealing with the system as poorly designed as it is. What we're all looking at is a very bright future, which says the industry will be much larger because we can make the decision-making easier by giving pilots better information. And that the big surprise would be that once we have that better information, we don't have to wait for somebody on the ground to tell us where to go. We can really have an integrated system that does it in a much more internet, broadly networked sort of way. So it's a bright future as far as we're concerned. We're currently building a 4-seat propeller composite airplane. As Rich said, it's selling quite well, and it's been very, very long and frustrating getting this far. Certification, production, all these issues are always harder than you think. But we think it's a great future. As an industry, what we think we can do is change the way people think about their time and about their travel. That they will no longer think in terms of trains on tracks or airlines that fly to a certain point, or more importantly, they won't think about where they're not going to go because they don't have time. They will go where they need to go, when they need to go.
Alan, if you could just take a few minutes to describe the genesis of the parachute and your very personal near-traumatic incident that caused you to develop that vision.
We've got a number of safety features on the airplane, and the parachute is the most visible. It's probably not the most important in terms of really improving the safety, but it is the most visible. In the case of the parachute, I had a mid-air collision in 1985 while working on my instrument rating, and the guy in the other airplane died, and it was a person I knew from the next airport over. So naturally, when the technology of a parachute was presented to us in the early 1990s as a possibility, my reaction was, great idea, what's it going to take to make it work? An interesting part of it was that as we talked to this company, they'd already approached every traditional manufacturer, and every one of them had said, we don't need parachutes, we've got well-trained pilots, good, strong airplanes. And our view was, well, no, actually, things go wrong. We wanted to have the parachute as well. And because safety is one of the largest, the perception of safety is one of the largest barriers of entry for people looking at learning to fly, we felt that it would not only have real safety benefits, but marketing benefits as well. It had to do both. The genesis was a lot of really difficult physics kind of testing, not very far away from a high-tech process. It involved dropping 55-gallon drums full of wet sand out of the back of a C-123 over the Arizona desert, most of which created large craters in the ground when the parachute didn't work. But we were environmentally correct, and we took the barrels back out of the ground after digging them out of the holes. And so a lot of testing went into this to develop a system that really would work, and then a lot of substantiation to prove it to the FAA. One of the more interesting dilemmas was then convincing pilots that they should actually use it. One of the other characteristics of pilots in the past, and part of the Superman complex, is that they're always going to figure out how to do something else to save themselves as opposed to just say, okay, I'm going to pull the parachute and let that save me. So we certainly had some accidents early on where we looked at the accident and we'd go, why didn't they use the parachute? Well, it was slow getting people to the point where they'd think that they should use the parachute. Now we have a little bit of the opposite problem. We've had 9 uses, 21 lives saved, and we have some people saying, well, they shouldn't have used the parachute. They should have done A, B, or C. My view is, no, use the parachute, be alive, let everybody else tell you what else you should have done, but at least be there for the debate.
Yeah. Vern, information technology is shot through eclipse on so many levels, from you're raising a substantial amount of money from tech people such as Bill Gates to not only the great avionics that you have inside of the plane, but the manufacturing process, which reduces the number of labor hours by 2/3 with your use of robotics to other ways that you've used technology. You're really it's Moore's Law takes to the skies.
Well, there's definitely an element of that. Let me start with 2 points first. In one of my prior incarnations and careers, I was on the original development team of PowerPoint, so you have my profound apologies. And I will not use it today. Second, thank you, Rich, for scheduling this panel after such a trivial, unimportant presentation by Michael. So we'll at least talk about little airplanes. Let me start before I answer your question directly, Rich, with kind of a situational analysis, if you will, which is Rick and Alan have both said a lot of what I'll say, so I'm going to try to say it a little bit different, which is if you look at the history of aviation, and in particular look at the role that general aviation has played in the development of this country, it's only a relatively recent phenomenon. Really, I'd put it starting in the very late 70s and early 80s, that general aviation became somewhat irrelevant to travel in this nation. If you go back into the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the general aviation played a really crucial and key role in the overall transportation infrastructure, and it was a big, vibrant industry. And in fact, in 1978, the industry produced just under 18,000 aircraft. Now, a really significant event occurred in 1978. It was called airline deregulation, which took the shackles of competition off the airline industry. Now, independent of whether we're in the last act of a Greek tragedy as far as airlines are concerned, the fact is we've seen travel by airlines more than triple in less than three decades. But we also saw general aviation essentially disappear. In 1992, we only manufactured 600 airplanes for the entire industry. Alan and Dale were a significant component of bringing that back, because I think all three of us shared the basic concept, which is not only is there a need for transportation that isn't sort of the buses in the sky, there are ways to change, and Alan used the word, and I hardly endorse it, there are ways to change the value to people of transportation. Yesterday's a perfect example. Just like Alan, I flew myself in here yesterday, except I started out in the morning by first going east to Wichita for a three-hour meeting, and then flying back to Albuquerque and picking up some people, and then flying into the Truckee Airport over here at about 5 in the afternoon. So you can't do that on the airlines. In fact, ironically, we have less service as measured by scheduled transportation to runways in the United States today than any point since World War II. Less than 500 communities have any form of airline service, and that's in a nation that has over 10,000 airports. So the concept was really straightforward. How do you change the value proposition for personal travel? And to that end, I approached this more from a standpoint of taking technology and using technology to fundamentally change how aircraft are built and how they're operated. We've pioneered a lot of things, like Rick has, and Alan have both gone down the composite trail. We instead chose to stay with a tried and true material system, but change radically how it's assembled. We weld aircraft together, we don't rivet them together. To the way we have completely digitized the aircraft. It's not just the panel and what the pilot interacts with. This entire aircraft, all the hydraulics have been eliminated, all the controls are microprocessor based. There's over 200 microprocessors in this aircraft. We do things like health monitoring, so we measure when the landing gear is coming up, where it is versus time versus voltage versus current, and we can actually project failures using that data. We actually capture about 7 megabytes of data per hour flight. Standard flight data recorder type stuff, but also health monitoring is just what the airplane's doing. And that's downlinked to our headquarters in Albuquerque via Iridium satellite data link. So we actually capture more data on production aircraft than Boeing does on a 777 today. And so there's this whole technology approach, including technology business models. We build an aircraft because of the way we designed it and the way we outsource most of the components. I mean, most of our building we assemble, we don't actually fabricate. So we build an aircraft in 4 days. By the time we paint it and test it and deliver it, it's about 10 days later, and then about 20 days after that, I pay for it. So in some ways, we're a Dell of aircraft company. There's still lots and lots of time and effort that goes into building that airplane, but I don't pay for it, so my overhead absorption is extraordinarily low, so my price can be low. All this combines, along with the reliability and the safety that's engineered in the aircraft, to build an aircraft that fundamentally can offer, and Rick did a nice job of outlining the opportunity, an individual form of transportation at the mass travel level of cost. And we think that with that happening, we're about to see a revolution, we're about to see a renaissance in how people travel, not only here in the United States, but we actually see these aircraft as a form of leapfrog technology that can have huge implications in countries around the world, be it a China or an India or a South America or a South Africa or a Persian Gulf, you name it. All these places that need additional transportation, they're coming up on the curve the same way we did in the United States about 30 years ago. This can be an aircraft that actually helps them accelerate past that, just like wired phones are no longer sold in China. We think that there's a possibility that you'll see not the replacement of cars, but a supplemental of cars that avoid building some of the highways. So we think there's great opportunity for this change.
I want to talk about this developing air taxi network that you're particularly the Rick and Vern share a vision for that. A large percentage of their sales will come from air taxi operators, whereas Alan's more on the personal end, and then maybe Alan, you might tell us about an announcement, give some hint of an announcement that you're making in a couple of weeks. But let's talk about the air taxi system and the economics. Today, you got into it a little bit, Rick. The problem with charters today, and the thing that keeps charters expensive, one, you're talking about older generation aircraft that are much less fuel efficient, but you also have the deadhead problem. When you want to fly, charter a plane to fly from Truckee to Albuquerque, you're really having to pay for it both ways, because the odds of somebody being on the other end in Albuquerque who immediately wants to come to Truckee are pretty low. But if you get a critical mass of these critters in the air, combined with the fuel efficiency, you have some potential for something really new. Rick and Vern, do you want to take a stab at that?
Go first. If you charter an airplane today, as Rich said, or you go to a fraction like NetJets and those guys, they have implicit in their pricing, they fly empty 50 or 60% of the time, and that's embedded in the pricing. If you get a critical mass or a network effect, and we've seen models of our customers where they're modeling out 40% empty, 30% empty, 20% empty, it has a dramatic effect on their cost structure and ultimately the price to you. So that, coupled with airplanes that cost half as much or a third as much and operated a third less or 50% less, you know, get you into one of these virtuous cycles where it's really elastic. There are some parts of the country that appear to be more amenable to this, and the early ones look like they're gonna pop up in Texas and California, the Northeast and Florida. Florida's a particularly interesting market, and Vern probably knows more about this than I do, but there's very poor diagonal either air traffic or car traffic across Florida, and if you drop a customer off, you're very likely to pick one up right there. But if there's not one right there in a 10 or 15 minute repositioning flight, you can pick up your next fare. And so you can model, you know, much better than 50% empty in your financial models.
I think that the real opportunity here is to take some of the technology, and this really does end up being a convergence type of situation. The best way for any of you who have any background operations research, this is the traveling salesman problem, OR 101. And how do you allocate transportation? What's the optimization? And it's going to be done with network theory. And the concept is really simple. How do you minimize the amount of deadheading time or repositioning time? Not necessarily how do you optimize for getting as many butts in as many seats as you possibly can. That's the basic airline model today, which is they optimize and they provide you incentives as a customer to travel on their convenience. What the air taxi model will do is it'll serve communities not served, it'll take people off the highways, and they'll give you a choice of how you optimize your price based on the time value, to Alan's point. In other words, if you want to leave at a very specific time as opposed to within a window of time, it'll be one price, it'll be more expensive for you to leave at that time, it'll be less expensive for you to leave within a big window of time. So it's inverting the yield management model pretty significantly and letting the customer drive the value equation as opposed to the service provider driving the value equation. When you combine all that, as I say, with the reduced acquisition costs, the reduced operating costs, the safety of turbine, and just as a sidebar, if you do look at the safety of air travel in the United States, the world, and you go back into the era of the DC-3s and 6s and 7s and Connies and Martins and Convairs, the safety record wasn't very good. But we can trace the safety record we have today, which, just to make sure we're all on the same page, there is no safer way to travel anywhere, including walking, than on airlines. The fact that we've gone over 5 years with a total of 49 fatalities in 5 years, of which those 49 just occurred 3 weeks ago in Lexington, Kentucky, and there's over 12,000 departures a day, is nothing short of a miracle from a system safety standpoint. And so But what triggered that was the invention of the turbine engine. So all the aircraft that are being talked about here now have turbine engines, which leads to this level of safety. So when you combine that with the lowered operating costs, with the technology, and ultimately these air taxi networks, there will actually be a disambiguation dialogue, if you will, between the airplanes themselves. You know, I'll go to Truckee, you go to Reno. No, I'll go over to Placerville, you go to Auburn Hills. We're going to see an extraordinarily efficient network, a cloud, if you will, that can distribute these aircraft and handle massive disruptions without disrupting the schedule or the service level. So we think it's an inevitability that this form of transportation will occur, and contrary to what the Air Transport Association says, it's not going to bring the air traffic control system to its knees, and it's not going to take a lot of passengers out of airlines. In fact, we think most of the passengers are going to come off the highway.
Alan, you got